This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last weekend, I went to the Guggenheim Museum in New York to see their very popular exhibit, The Art of the Motorcycle. And out of the more than 100 bikes on display, the Indian was the one that got the most oohs and ahs. It was an American-made bike that went out of business some 50 years ago. But during its heyday, the company built beautiful bikes, which are rare and growing in popularity. Most motorcyclists today dream of owning an Indian, if only they could find one. Fred Haefeli had just such a fantasy. He paid $5,000 for a jumble of Indian parts called, in motorcycle lingo, a basket case. He then spent many more dollars and a lot of time looking for parts, hanging out with bikers, and finally rebuilding an Indian. In fact, Rebuilding the Indian is the name of his memoir, which is about the adventures he had putting his bike together and about putting his life back together after a failed marriage. We spoke as Haefeli was preparing to leave for Sturgis, the big motorcycle rally held each year in South Dakota. I asked him where he got the idea of buying an Indian.
It was an assignment, essentially. I was unable to sell my novel, and my agent had lunch with an editor, and this is the, I guess, the unromantic side of this particular saga. And the editor said, boy, you know, it'd be really neat. You know what'd be really neat? It'd be really neat if somebody went to one of these old parts guys and put together an Indian. And I had had motorcycles in my youth, and but not for 25 years or so. And I always felt I had unfinished business with motorcycles. And said, yeah, I'll sign on. But then after that, things changed very rapidly, and this editor was suddenly gone. And in the meantime, I had signed contracts for this book, and days after I signed the contracts, maybe the next day, I discovered my wife was pregnant. And I knew this was going to dramatically affect the the contour of this book, which was originally would have been a lot more about the mechanics and more about the kind of renegade types that I ended up bumping into and so on, and ended up being much more about family.
Well, I notice in the way that you write about this quest, first of all, to find the parts to build the bike and then the rebuilding process itself, is that it all seemed to coincide with your being in your 50s, and not to sort of belabor this midlife crisis thing. It was your self-described midlife crisis that seemed to be going on.
I did, but of course we all know midlife crisis is kind of a nice shorthand for any crossroads,
right,
that a person encounters in their life. And gosh, I mean, as far as that goes, I probably had my first midlife crisis in my early 20s, as I recall, but I didn't know that's what it was.
You just perfected it over the years.
Exactly.
Right?
But, you know, in actuality, I suppose it was. It was a crossroads in my life in a number of ways. I was contemplating starting a new family. I was trying to figure out what was wrong with, what had gone wrong with my writing career, and so on. And so it was definitely a crossroads.
But you want to do something foolish?
I did want to do something foolish. I needed to do something foolish. I don't know any other way to describe it. That was perfectly from the heart.
Well, what
shot in the dark.
And what did was it's hard to buy an Indian motorcycle because they're so rare. But what people do is buy an Indian basket case.
Correct.
And that is exactly the way it describes, which is literally parts of an Indian.
Yes, and, you know, a quantity of parts. And typically a basket case will be, certainly you need the frame. You need most of an engine. It's nice to have the tanks. It's nice to have the brakes and wheels, but you don't always get that stuff. So, yeah, you got a questionable pile there. And also... the restorers use that term pile interchangeably with a basket case, which kind of has a nice overtones to it. But in any event, Yeah, that's what I got. And, you know, I could see the frame was probably okay, and that I probably had most of the motor parts and some of the wheels and a lot of stuff I was going to have to get. And some of the stuff that was there was fixable and I'd have to work with, and some of it was not. So first thing to do is to sort through all the stuff and figure out what stays and goes and then what you need.
Well, I want to have you read from the opening of your book. And
sure.
This, I think, connects very directly to this whole quest for parts.
Okay. The first chapter is called Parts Fathers. Maybe in the way of explanation, there was actually a biker who lived here for years. I never met him. He died just before I embarked on my my quest for parts. But he's a guy who just... He helped a lot of people with their motorcycles, and his name kept popping up again and again all over the country. People knew this guy. Oh, you're from Missoula. You must know Parts Father. It was something I kind of had to run with. And so I start out with this. It's a popular biker myth, let's say, or something like an urban legend. You hear the story in a million configurations, but it's always the same story, and it's about... the lost parts trove out there somewhere. And the book begins like this. Once upon a time in the Pacific Northwest, there lived a handsome young biker named Benny. One afternoon in early fall, Benny was out burning highway on his 53 Harley Panhead, and somewhere north of Corvallis, he stopped at a roadhouse for refreshment. The only customer in the place was an old farmer drinking by himself at the bar. And the two men struck up a conversation, and before long, they were talking motorcycles. When Benny mentioned he was restoring a 46 Indian Chief, the old man's eyes lit up. He cocked his head, fixed Benny with a peculiar stare that made the young biker uneasy. The farmer made a veiled reference to some old junk he had squirreled away in his barn, and then summoned the bartender and bought another round. The hour grew late. It began to rain. The farmer suggested Benny sleep at his place a few miles up the road. Benny followed the old man's pickup on his bike, but soon lost the headlights in a heavy fog. Benny throttled back, pulled over at a crossroads, and swore. With zero visibility and the rain pounding down, he rolled his panhead into a dilapidated barn by the roadside, spread his sleeping bag out on the hard dirt floor, and fell quickly into a dreamless sleep. Next morning, sunlight streamed through the cracks of the barn, and Benny rose, blurry-eyed, hungover, to find himself in a fabulous place. Every rafter, loft, stall, and stanchion in that barn was crammed with Indian motorcycle parts. Chief frames and scout fenders, connecting rods, flywheels, gas tanks, engine cases, pistons, seats, kicker forks, and sprockets. Benny looked around in wonder. He knew very well what had happened. He'd had the sheer dumb luck to stumble onto every biker's mother lode, the lost city of parts.
And that's our guest, Fred Haefele, reading from his new book. It's a memoir called Rebuilding the Indian. So is that every biker's dream to stumble across an old barn and find it just crammed full of all the parts and bikes you'd ever dreamed about?
I certainly can't speak for every biker, but I went through a phase where that was my dream. And I actually bumped into people, more often than not, they were men in their 60s and 70s who happened to have all the parts that I so longed for, but who also were well aware of their worth. And so in reality, the parts are very expensive.
Yeah.
The rarer they are, the more necessary they are, the more expensive they are.
Well, I wonder what that experience was like, having spent so many months working on the bike, getting the parts together, rebuilding it to some degree yourself, when you actually got it started and out on the road. What was that like?
It was terrifying. Just because I'd invested so much time and effort in the project by that point, and but more than anything, I remember one time I rode the bike over. My agent was in town, and we were having this little party, and it was only a few blocks away. And I rode the bike over, and I rolled up on it, and killed the engine, and I thought, well, that was, you know, pretty smooth and everything. And both my agent and my wife were laughing, and they said, God, you know, you just look absolutely terrified on that thing. And I thought, oh, my God, don't say that, because I was trying to look cool. But they said, no, you look terrified. And I thought, well, of course I do. I'm afraid I'm going to put this thing right up a telephone pole, and or I'm going to break it, or it's going to fall apart, or any of the thousand things that can happen with a motorcycle. And that would be that, you know.
And that cliche about the road, about the freedom of the road and the wind in your hair, and, you know, all the cliches about riding a motorcycle, are they true?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's one always comes back to that. And it is like flying, you know, it's as close as you'll come to flying without a plane, I believe. And of course, that's the attraction that people come back to again and again with motorcycles. And, you know, of course, they're rediscovering them now with this big exhibit at the Guggenheim and so on. And it's, you know, motorcycles are, they're a, how can I? I was going to say they're a cheap high, but you know, mine was anything but cheap. But they are a high. They're exhilarating. They're exposure, danger, speed. They're wonderful.
I tell you what, I want to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. Fun. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Fred Haefele, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called Rebuilding the Indian, and it's a memoir of rebuilding an Indian motorcycle and, in a sense, rebuilding his life. We will talk about that after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and tree surgeon Fred Haefele, and his book is called Rebuilding the Indian. Well, just to milk these cliches even more, we talked about the cliches of the road, the cliches of rebuilding a motorcycle as a kind of metaphor for rebuilding your own life. Did that turn out to be true? And as you wrote about it, it seemed like there were some real parallels going on.
Yeah, it's amazing. How did it work out that way? It's almost as if I set out to write a kind of a feel-good book, which I did anything but. I guess I should say at the outset, I was astonished to find I was writing a memoir. Mm-hmm. I usually imagine that you have to have a fairly interesting life to write a memoir, but yet there I was writing a memoir, because all this stuff was suddenly happening, and there were a number of parallels there that just naturally introduced themselves. The second family. Earlier in our interview, I talked about having unfinished business with motorcycles. I never quite got the right bike or went where I really wanted to go on bikes, and suddenly here was this motorcycle in my life. And it was the same with my family. I was divorced and never really got to know my children as I would like to have. And suddenly I had I had unfinished business with children, and suddenly I had a second chance at that too. And in some ways that did drive things there, and it certainly drove the book. I could not keep going with either project, the new family or the bike, and not kind of try to figure out what the connection could be, I guess.
Well, you write poignantly, I must say, about your first son, or your son from your first marriage, and you really were estranged from him and found out that he was having pretty serious problems. He was even incarcerated.
He did. He's about as far away from that phase of his life now as I can imagine. But yes, he did have some problems with the law. And I don't know. In a lot, I had my own problems with the law as a young man. And I guess I took that as an opportunity to reflect on young men in general, and restless young men, and what they do when they are unfocused and haven't figured out what they want to do yet. But the change with Kyle has been phenomenal, and he's a wonderful young man.
But did you feel responsible as an absent father for what his life was at that point?
I'm sure I very likely did, but all this was just in the realm of speculation. I, of course, had problems, unresolved difficulties with my own father, who was not an absent father. He was a present father, but we had plenty of difficulties. And it got me to wondering, you know, which is worse, being an absent father without that particular baggage, or a present father who, in my own father's case, perhaps did not really want to be there. I'd venture that.
But you also write about having a relationship with your first two children and connecting with your son.
I did, and that was one of the most one of the happiest moments of my recent years of the last 10 years, was to see Kyle again, and I reconnected with him in New York over the I guess in the course of the summer.
Does he feel like a son to you?
In some ways, he does. In the book, I describe him as kind of a dream figure. He was this lost child who would show up in my dreams periodically. So there was another kind of quest going on there with Kyle. Where is he? Over the past, 10 years or so, when he'd become an adult, I began to try to seek him out, you know, just to find out who he was, I think, in the end. I didn't feel like I needed to get sloppy and bond with him. I needed to know who he was. Mm-hmm. And for all I know, he felt the same about me, because he did come to see me. So we'll see where all this takes us.
You're heading on out to Sturgis, which is a famous motorcycle gathering that's held in South Dakota.
Well, it's the heartbeat of the biker nation.
Absolutely. So when you head on out there, do you take a great big toolkit with you, knowing that something will probably happen to your Indian?
I am not riding the Indian down this year. I'm packing it down in the back of my truck, which is kind of ignominious. But
isn't that cheating?
That's a harsh word, cheating. I'm giving myself an advantage. And if we were playing golf, what would you call that? A mulligan or something like that. It is and it isn't. I've got a new baby at home and a 2-year-old, and I think it's very important for me to do this in as little time as possible. And so that's why I'm packing it down. I am signing down there, and that would be on Thursday. And we're going to do it in 3 days, which is really a burnout. And so I have no recourse but to pack the bike down this time. Otherwise, this would be a 5 or 6 day expedition. And if I was gone that long again this summer, I don't know what would be waiting for me when I came home, frankly. My wife's been very patient about all this, and so far, so good.
Yeah. Do you have a tattoo?
No. Strange you should bring that up. I'm waiting for the right time and the right moment and the right incentive and so on. But how I wrestled with the idea of a tattoo, you know, and if yes, what, you know, what should it be?
And where to put it, of course.
I'll know it when I see it. This is all instinctive, and I'll know where to put it too. I'm sure I will. But no, I do not at this time have a tattoo, but my son does, and my oldest son, and so does my oldest daughter, curiously, and so I'm the only guy left to not to have one.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Fred Haefele, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It was great fun.
Fred Haefele's memoir is Rebuilding the Indian.